Larry let Stevie off on the circular drive.
Come by the great house in the morning,
he said.
Dr. Scott wants to talk with you to get you set up. 10 o'clock.
Yeah, she said. 10, I'll be there.
Right then. Good night. I'll see your stuff is delivered.
Stevie walked toward Minerva House. The air was biting and cold, her footsteps loud and crisp on the stone pathways. Overhead, the trees made an unbroken canopy that blocked out the moon. She tightened her arms around herself as her head swam a bit. Anxiety again, percolating. So much of anxiety was anxiety about having anxiety. Would it come tonight? Would it suddenly wrap its fingers around her neck and warp the world now, at the moment when she should be happiest? Would the universe crunch itself into a ball and ping itself right between her eyes? There was a pleasant smell of wood smoke. There was a fire somewhere. The smell should have warmed her and made her happy, but it reminded her how far this place was and different, and how much had been loaded on her today. She stopped and took a long breath through the nose and held it. Long exhale through the mouth in a steady plume of frost. She had been doing her breathing exercises every night for half an hour, religiously. They helped her take back some control, helped her body complete the cycle and reset itself. After a minute or so of this, the wood smoke became pleasant again. Or at least not as scary. She was going home, to her friends, to the place she loved. There was nothing to be frightened of. She continued down the path. The tree cover was breaking, and there was a building ahead of her. In the dark, the tower on the end loomed a bit, and the Virginia creeper looked a bit creepier than in the daytime. The blue door was just as welcoming, and there were lights on in the common room and Janelle's room. Upstairs, all the lights were off but on one end, Nate's room. Stevie reached to her pocket for her pass to tap herself in before she remembered that she no longer had one. She stood there for a moment, unsure of what to do. She was about to go over to Janelle's window when the door opened.
Stevie!
Pix, Dr. Nell Pixwell, the faculty resident of Minerva, was wrapped in a massive plaid flannel robe. She had allowed her shaved head to grow to the point where there was a faint brown buzz showing. A winter cut for warmth. She raised her arms in the air in a cheerful greeting.
I only got the call an hour ago. I'm so glad. I'm so glad. We missed you so much. Get in here.
The common room of Minerva was swelteringly warm. There was a fire crackling away in the fireplace, where two smiling pumpkins stood at attention at either end of the mantelpiece. The moose head over the fireplace had been decorated in orange and black winking lights. Enough time had passed since she left that they had started preparing for Halloween.
Janelle probably has her headphones on or she would have already come out, Pix said. She's going to faint from shock. Go on, go say hello.
Stevie walked slowly to the hallway where the downstairs rooms were and knocked on Janelle's door. When there was no reply, she knocked louder. After a moment, Janelle appeared in blue flannel pajamas covered in pictures of cat heads and her crafting tool belt at her waist, a handmade blue canvas wraparound with deep pockets full of wire cutters and a variety of tools Stevie could not identify. She had put her hair up in two bunches, and her headphones were around her neck, still playing music loudly. She stood in her doorway for a moment, unmoving. Then...
Oh my God, what is happening? Why didn't you tell me? When did this happen? Oh my God!
Stevie was wrapped in a massive hug that smelled of orange blossom perfume, coconut oil, pumpkin, and a tiny bit of industrial solvent.
How? How?
Janelle stepped back and felt Stevie by her shoulders to take a good look at her.
How?
It happened fast, Stevie said. Like, today fast. They changed their minds.
What? What? Oh my God!
In the next moment, she had Stevie by the wrist and was pulling her along to the tight circular stairs at the end of the hall. Stevie had a moment of remembrance here. On the day she arrived at Ellingham Academy, the first person she met in Minerva was Hayes Major. He recruited her into carrying his stuff up these cramped, twisting steps. She had been profusely sweating, and he looked so cool and crisp. He kept talking about phone calls he was getting or making to people in L.A.,
And Stevie had no idea why he was telling her about his phone calls, because she had not asked and did not care. But that was Hayes all over. All talk about his movie deal and how popular he was, getting people to do his work. These stares would always make her think of Hayes. When Janelle and Stevie knocked on Nate's upstairs door, all was quiet for a moment. Janelle knocked louder, and eventually the door creaked open. Nate had pushed all the furniture and all of his belongings up against the walls. His desk chair was upside down on his desk, the bed tipped up to make floor space. On the wooden floor, there was some kind of pattern, a spidery form of blobs and lines made from carefully sliced black masking tape. Nate sat in the center of the web, dressed in faded blue flannel pajama bottoms and a saggy green t-shirt that said, "I'm here because my grandkids aren't going to spoil themselves." His room smelled of a spicy clove supermarket air freshener and a general light boy stink. It was a warm, strangely welcoming smell. "Look," Janelle said, pointing to Stevie. "Look, look, look." Nate blinked at Stevie, then slowly unfolded his long frame from the ground. His hair had not been cut since his arrival at school, so it was hanging low over his forehead and scraping his neck. He was a few hours behind on a shave, and he scratched at the shadow along his chin. Nate had the same expression Stevie had come to love, vaguely annoyed by everything, except maybe Stevie and Janelle, but for sure everything else.
"Is this a trick?"
he asked, raising one eyebrow. "Not a trick, not a trick," Janelle said. "She just showed up." "Poof," Stevie added.
"And you're back?"
"From outer space," Stevie said.
"What's it like out there?"
"You don't want to know," Stevie replied. "Nate, she is back. What are you doing?" Janelle said. "She's back." Janelle bounced on the balls of her feet a bit.
"I'm hugging you with my mind,"
he replied. "I'm awkwardly accepting your hug in my mind," Stevie said. "And what are you doing?" She pointed to the tape creation on the floor.
"Writing,"
he replied. "With tape? On the floor?"
"It's a map,"
he said, gazing around. "Of Moonbright?"
"No."
It was best not to make further inquiries. Stevie looked down the dark hall to David's room. There was no light coming from under the door, and no sound at all.
"He's not home,"
Nate said.
"Or, I don't know, maybe he is. I wouldn't bother."
"Come on," Janelle said. "Let's get her stuff in." As Janelle headed for the stairs, Nate slipped Stevie one of his rare smiles.
"How did you do it?"
he asked. Stevie's mind flickered back to Edward King and her promise not to speak. It would not help her. It wouldn't help anyone.
"Magic happens," she said.
Stevie's sad pile of belongings had turned up in the common room. Pix gave Stevie the key to her room. As she unlocked the door, Stevie was at first shocked by the dark and the cold of this once familiar space. When she switched on the light, she heard a moth start bumping confusedly against the shade. The walls were bare, the drawers still half open from when she had dumped the contents so sadly and unceremoniously the other week. The closet door was half open as well. It looked like exactly what it was, the scene of a person leaving in a hurry, tears in her eyes. Between the three of them, they made short work of getting the boxes and bags inside. Stevie opened a garbage bag full of clothes and dumped them out, which made Janelle recoil and run for hangers and a fabric steamer. Nate unpacked her books, something Stevie would never have allowed anyone else to do. Tonight was special, though, and Nate was careful with them, putting them into sensible stacks by genre and type. "So," Stevie said, testing the waters again. "Where's David? You made it seem like he's out or something." Janelle paused, her hand in the pile of Stevie's crumpled sheets. She and Nate shared a look.
"Oh, he's here," Janelle said.
She let that remark hang in the air for a second.
"Okay,"
Stevie said, looking at the two of them.
"What does that mean?"
"She means,"
Nate said, turning away from the books,
"that David has gone full weird."
"He was always that way,"
Janelle said in a low voice.
Yeah, but now he's completed his journey. Our little caterpillar has turned into a freaky butterfly.
Tell her about the screaming, Janelle said, because I can't.
The screaming? Stevie repeated.
The other morning he started something called screaming meditation, Nate said. Guess what happens in screaming meditation? Did you guess screaming for 15 minutes? Because that's what happens in screaming meditation. 15 minutes outside at 5 in the morning. Do you know what happens when someone screams outside for 15 minutes at 5 in the morning at a remote location in the mountains, especially after a...
The implied dot 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 was student dies in a terrible accident or maybe murder and another one goes missing.
When security got to him, he claimed it was his new religion and that it is something he needs to do every morning now as a way to talk to the sun.
So this is what Edward King had been referring to.
Sometimes,
Nate went on, tapping the books into place so that the spines lined up perfectly.
He sleeps on the roof, or somewhere else. Sometimes the green.
Naked, Janelle added. He sleeps on the green, naked.
Or in classrooms,
Nate said.
Someone said they went into differential equations and he was asleep in the corner of the room under a Pokemon comforter.
Your boy has not been well, Janelle said. Nothing was right here without you, but now you're back. Everything will be okay again.
Nate left not long afterward so that Janelle and Stevie could talk. Stevie found she was exhausted, though. Earlier that evening, she had been at the Funky Monkey. Now she was back at Ellingham. Everything that happened in between made no sense. Sensing that Stevie needed to sleep, Janelle made up the bed to her personal satisfaction and watched as Stevie drank a full bottle of water to help her readjust to the altitude. Then she put a second bottle by Stevie's bedside.
Vi's going to meet us at brunch tomorrow, she said. Get some rest. I'm right next door if you need me.
Janelle knew that Stevie sometimes had panic attacks at night.
Thanks, Stevie said. For everything.
When Janelle was gone, Stevie stood at her window for a long time, looking out at the dark and her own reflection. Like the stairs, the window came with a memory. The night before Hayes died, she had a dream. At least, she was pretty sure it was a dream. She remembered light, and looking at her wall, and seeing words on her wall, like the truly devious lettering. She had not been able to make them all out, and the message was scrambled in her mind. Stevie had awakened with a jolt and rolled out of bed, crawled along the floor to this very window. She had pushed a heavy textbook out of it, hoping to strike anyone who was lurking underneath, but no one was. It never made any sense that anyone would project a message like that on her wall. It was too much work, making the image, getting something to project it, hiding in the dark. People did complicated things at Ellingham, but there was no one she could think of who would do something that elaborate to her. Except maybe David. David was probably capable of an elaborate joke. But he liked her, as it turned out, so why do it? And this had happened right before Hayes died. What were the chances? Janelle had spoken to her that night, talked her through it, about dreams that were so vivid they completely mimicked reality. It was why some people think they see ghosts in the night, or figures by their bed. The space between sleep and consciousness can be thin. And Stevie had been fully immersed in the Ellingham story on that day, and had actually gone into the tunnel where the kidnappers had been. Her brain was full of the crime and was projecting it back at her. Stevie turned back and looked at the place on the wall where the message had been, even if only in her mind. What had it said? Riddle, riddle on the wall. Something murder. Something about a body in a field. Something Alice. This was the wall that she had shared with Ellie. Minerva was so empty, so doomed. Dottie Epstein and Hayes Major were dead, and Element Walker was on the run. Was it Ellie? Was the note some kind of art thing? Did it have something to do with the trick she played on Hayes with the dry ice? Did Ellie have a broken sense of humor, or did she secretly hate everyone? Ellie didn't seem like the hating kind, but you never knew. Stevie crossed the room and went to her bag, which was resting on the floor in the corner of the room, and removed the tin. When she reached inside this time, she wanted only one of the objects, the photographs. One in particular. It was thicker than the others because it was actually stuck to another photo. What was between the photos was the key. It was a word. A single word cut out of a magazine. The word us. This word, these two letters stuck between some old photos, was the reason Stevie had to be here. Because this word was the first clue in 80 years. The Ellingham case was often called the truly devious case, because the family had received a letter that week informing of the crime to come. It was composed of cut-out letters from magazines and newspapers. Stevie, like any person devoted to the case, could recite it by heart. Look, a riddle. Time for fun. Should we use a rope or gun? Knives are sharp and gleam so pretty. Poison's slow, which is a pity. Fire is festive. Drowning's slow. Hanging's a ropey way to go. A broken head, a nasty fall, a car colliding with a wall. Bombs make a very jolly noise. Such ways to punish naughty boys. What shall we use? We can't decide. Just like you cannot run or hide. Ha, ha. Truly devious. What she had found in Ellie's room was proof that there were students on the campus who loved gangsters, who wrote poetry about taking down the king on the hill who liked to play games, and who were cutting words out of magazines and gluing them into things. In short, she had found that Truly Devious could have been a student here at Ellingham. And if Truly Devious could have been a student, then a student could take them down, even all these years later. That is, if this student could deal with the person who was somewhere above her now, someone she longed to go up and see, someone whose presence thrummed through the floorboards. She felt her body growing warm just knowing David was so close. She recalled every sense, every touch, the soft curl of his hair, the curve of his neck, his kiss. Edward King's voice was in her head, making a mockery of everything she had ever felt about David. She could not go upstairs. She could not look for him. Maybe she had to avoid him forever. Avoid the feeling. Avoid all contact. That was the only way. She clutched her comforter and pulled it over her face, blotting out the scene and calling down the night. Crimestuff.com, 5 Legends of Ellingham Academy. You know the story of Ellingham Academy and the famous kidnapping/murder plot, but did you know these twists in the tale? 1. Alice in the Attic. According to one story, Albert Ellingham engineered the kidnapping himself as part of a game. When the game went wrong and 2 people died, he had to cover up what he had done. He took his daughter, Alice, back to the house and raised her there in the attic. Servants were told not to go there, even when they heard her footsteps above them. Eventually, Alice became too old for the attic, and when she could not escape, took her own life. Her ghost walks the floors there, and some people say you can hear her playing with her toys. 2. The Secret of the Lake. Another story claims that Iris and Alice Ellingham were not kidnapped at all. In this version, Iris had a breakdown and murdered Alice by drowning her in the lake on the property. This event was witnessed by a student named Dottie Epstein. In order to keep this secret, Dottie was killed and the kidnapping story was invented. Iris was kept hidden, but she eventually escaped and killed herself. In despair over what had transpired, Albert Ellingham later drained the lake. Naturally, the ghosts of Iris, Alice, and Dottie still appear on the edge of where the lake once was. So many ghosts. 3. The Sunken Treasure. Pirates rejoice. Is there a sunken treasure to be had? This story claims that after his wife's body was found, Albert Ellingham collected her jewels and dropped them into Lake Champlain in a weighted box. So if you have scuba gear and some time on your hands, you might want to have a look. No ghosts, but treasure is better anyway. 4. The heir to the throne. If you thought that last one sounded good, this story will blow you away. This report claims that after the kidnapping and murders, Albert Ellingham rewrote his will, leaving his fortune to anyone who could find his daughter, dead or alive, provided they were not responsible for the crimes. The Ellingham estate and businesses are worth in excess of $2 billion today. Get hunting. 5. The kidnapping that never was. No ghosts or fortunes here, just a damn good game. This story claims that the kidnapping and murders at Ellingham Academy never happened at all. The entire affair, the search, the investigation, the bodies, all of it was part of Albert Ellingham's greatest game. The student who died, Dottie Epstein, was an actor. The game concluded when he faked his own death in an explosion 2 years later. In this happy ending version, all the players were alive and lived together in complete anonymity, leaving fortune and fame behind. Or at least fame. They probably took the fortune. So which one do you like? The ghosts, the treasure, or the happy ever after? 5. I want to jump in those, Janelle said, hopping ahead on the way to breakfast. But I don't want to mess up what they've done. It's so tempting. The next morning, Janelle, Stevie, and Nate were heading toward the dining hall. On weekends, the school offered brunch. Stevie had usually slept through this before, but the excitement of being back had woken her early. Even Nate emerged and came downstairs. They were now making their way to the green on an aggressively beautiful fall morning. The sky was a vibrant royal blue, a throbbing blue. Some of the maintenance crew were blowing leaves into gigantic mounds. Janelle was dressed for the occasion in a burnished orange sweater and jeans and a chunky black scarf with a spicy autumnal perfume that smelled of bergamot and clove. Stevie was wearing the least wrinkled and most likely to be clean clothes from the trash bag, a black hoodie and some stretched out gray leggings. This was not surprising, as 90% of Stevie's clothes were black or gray or stretched out, and her tops were more likely to be hooded than not. She marveled at Janelle, who moved through the patches of sun that came through the trees with her perfect style. It wasn't fancy, but it made every moment feel like an occasion. Many people existed. Janelle lived. Stevie looked up at the thick canopy of leaves over her head as she wound her way down the paths that snaked toward the great house. These were the early changing leaves, the prime ones, the burnished golds, and the meaty reds. As she reached the green, the view widened. Up here on the mountain, she had one of the best views of the bright halo of color that overtook the land. The view was hallucinatory, with oceans of gold and orange all around the horizon, marbled with red that looked like rivers of lava coming down from the mountaintops. She had never been an autumn person. The shortening of the days gave her the jitters, possibly because she had been prone to anxiety attacks at night. And the more night, the more possible anxiety. But it didn't have to be that way, and she decided she was going to become an autumn person here. Flannel was okay. Apples were fine. Pumpkins were the watermelons of fall. Were these the thoughts autumn people had? Was this even real? Last night, with Edward King in the living room and the plane ride and the bargain, and now this almost psychedelic view... Had she lost her mind some time ago? This one, Janelle said, stepping up to one of the massive leaf piles. I'm going in. Nate turned and regarded one of the piles with a scientific air.
A lot of animal feces in there, he said.
Nate,
Janelle said. I'm just saying, leaves are like a big litter box. Lots of animals up here. Foxes, deer, raccoons, moose.
No moose, Stevie said.
Birds, Nate went on. So much bird shit. Bat shit. Lots of bats. Bat shit is very valuable, you know. It's called guano.
I know what guano is, Janelle said in a warning tone. But I don't want to hear about poop. I want crispy leaf fun.
Squirrels still have to poop,
Nate continued. Squirrels have to poop, Stevie repeated sagely. Why are you ruining my perfect fall morning? Janelle asked.
We all have a calling, Nate said. This is mine.
Janelle made a low sound under her breath. Stevie got the feeling her friends were putting on a bit of a show for her. Janelle was extra perky, Nate a bit more dour. They were showing her it was all fine and normal and just like before. Except as they walked, Stevie was noting little objects on the trees, on light poles, on corners of buildings. Discreet little orbs. The eyes of Edward King.
There's a lot of new security, she said.
Oh, yeah, Janelle said. They did that last week.
I, for one, hail our new security overlords, Nate said loudly at the nearest orb.
I think it's a good idea, Janelle added. We're pretty remote here, and
things happened.
They were coming up on the cupola, where a makeshift memorial to Hayes was sitting in a state of minor decay. What shocked Stevie the most was the sheer quantity of sad. There were flowers, not scattered here or there in single roses, but bunches. Bunches sitting on dried and desiccated bunches, filling the entire floor. There were drawings and notes and pictures. There were small electronic candles, because real candles would have made the whole thing go up in a giant blaze.
They keep coming, Janelle said.
I guess they're slowing a little, but every day the deliveries come and maintenance puts them here. The wind stirred some of the now dying flowers on the memorial.
This is cheerful, Nate said. Can we eat? Let's be morbid over food.
The Ellingham Dining Hall was a large space that looked like a ski chalet. It had a high, peaked ceiling with exposed beams that crossed the space. These were now occupied by a line of jack-o'-lanterns, looking down judgmentally over the assembled. The cafeteria at Stevie's old school was a festival of linoleum, with hot metal trays full of tacos and tater tots and oversteamed broccoli. The Ellingham Dining Hall had been given more money to feed fewer people, and it did it with some style. It had automatic sensing dispensers that filled your bottle with still or sparkling water. The menus were written on blackboards in colored chalk. Brunch was a serious affair, with an omelet station, with tofu if you didn't eat eggs. There were fresh pancakes and waffles made with all kinds of berries, or bananas, or chocolate chips. Every breakfast meat was represented, along with their vegetarian counterparts. There was a make-your-own smoothie station, fresh bread, local honey, a whole shelf of teas, different coffee blends with every kind of milk, and, of course, there was maple syrup, the very lifeblood of Vermont. It was this warm syrup smell, along with the wood smoke on the breeze, that said Ellingham to Stevie. Stevie got a custom waffle with chocolate chips and a full ramekin of warm syrup. As she turned with her tray, she saw that she had been noticed. Assembled in front of her was all of Ellingham, or most of Ellingham. On the left, sitting with a few people from Juno, was Gretchen, Hayes' ex-girlfriend, the pianist. She had lent Hayes $500 and finally dumped him when she got tired of his user ways. Stevie had seen Gretchen and Hayes arguing on the day Hayes died. It was Gretchen who told Stevie how Hayes recruited other people to do his work. Gretchen was hard to miss, with her mighty crown of fiery red hair. Two tables down were Maris and Dash, the other two people who had worked on Hayes' video. Maris was a singer. She had jet black hair and tended to dress like she was always about to go perform a set at some smoky little cabaret. Today she wore a snug black sweater and a pair of jeans with high boots. She was fully made up, even though it was still pretty early on a Sunday. Maris always had a smoky eye. Dash was a stage manager who wore large, floppy clothes. He was the one who really ran the video production. They saw Stevie and Maris waved. This drew more attention, and got Kazim Bazir, the head of the student union, up on his feet and hurrying over.
Stevie!
He called.
Oh my God, when did you get back? This is amazing!
Last night, Stevie replied, suddenly feeling shy. It was a nice greeting, even though Stevie and Kaz didn't really know each other very well. Kaz was always enthusiastic. His special interest was the environment, and he spent a lot of time getting Ellingham to convert over to composting toilets. Kaz cared a lot about composting toilets. There was someone else watching closely, a small person with large, luminous eyes. She was wearing a brown sweater and peering at Stevie over the top of her tablet. Jermaine Batt. Technically, Jermaine had done nothing wrong. It wasn't her fault that her story was the thing that made Stevie's parents pull her out. But the feeling was still there. David was not in the dining hall.
How do you feel?
Nate asked as they walked to a table. Like the prettiest girl on Syrup Mountain, Stevie replied. They took a table by the window. Janelle's head was on a swivel. She was watching for Vi, of course. The three of them settled in to have their brunch. Stevie sliced into the crisp chocolate chip waffle and dipped it into the warm syrup. Vi Harper Tomo came bursting into the dining hall. Stevie had never really seen anyone burst into anywhere before, but that's what they did. Sending the door flying back, rushing in with arms flailing, Vi was dressed in their favorite outfit. White overalls and a gray sweatshirt, silver blonde hair spiked high. Vi greeted Stevie, much as Janelle had, with an incomprehensible string of affection.
I can't believe it, they said.
They turned to Janelle. There were greeting kisses at breakfast now, like a couple from TV. Nate tore his waffle slowly as the pair leaned cozily into one another.
You know we're cute, Janelle said to him.
Cuteness is my favorite, he said.
It's good for when you write romances in your book, right? Stevie said.
I don't write romance. I write about finding dragons and breaking magic rocks in half.
The real magic rocks are the friends we make along the way, Stevie replied, right?
He's happy for us, Janelle said. This is how he shows it.
Nate looked up at all of them, dark shadows under his eyes.
This is why I prefer books to people.
We love you too, Janelle said.
Even though Janelle had food, she accompanied Vi up to the food line. Nate centered his scrambled eggs on his plate.
So, he said, what changed your parents' minds?
Stevie dunked her waffle nervously into the syrup pool. Who knows?
They just said, we're sending you back?
I mean, Stevie nervously rubbed under her eye. We talked about it a little, but she was dancing on the edge of the truth, telling a lie of omission. One step could send her into falsehood. I don't know what motivates my parents, she said. There. She lied. So simple. It fell out of her mouth. Plop. You guys ever hear anything about Ellie? Stevie said, changing the conversation. What's going on with that? Nate was still studying Stevie's expression, but then he seemed to give up and returned to his eggs.
Nothing,
he said.
I mean, they looked. There were police around for a few days. Low-key, but they were around. I think they may have had dogs, even. She must have gone to Burlington. She knows a lot of people there.
Stevie sipped at her coffee and looked out the window. They were facing toward the back, to the thick line of trees that bordered the property. During the day, they were a bright, bold wall. At night, they loomed and contained multitudes. The area where the school was flat, but it dipped down dramatically as it went toward the road, and there was a river that bordered it on two sides. The other way out was up, toward jagged rocks and higher peaks and thicker woods. Getting out would not have been easy. Stevie wasn't even sure Ellie had a coat on when she vanished that night.
It's not your fault,
Nate said.
What? It's not your fault,
he repeated.
Whatever Ellie has done, why she ran, that's not on you.
I know that, she said, concentrating on the squares and her waffles.
Are people saying this is my fault?
No, he said quickly. No, forget I said anything. I think Vi and Janelle are about to make out on top of those mugs.
Stevie turned and saw Vi and Janelle locked in an intense embrace by the coffee station.
It's been a long week, Nate said. Don't leave again. Don't leave me with these people.
Which people?
Any people.
I don't count as people?
Of course not,
he said.
It's been all feelings and love. I want to go back to numbness and avoidance. You're great at that stuff.
She smiled and tapped her phone to check the time. I have to go, she said. Meeting with Call Me Charles.
Go forth and learn or whatever. I'll see you at home.
Home. Yes, this was home. This home welcomed her as she was, which was unusual in her experience. It was also, and more familiarly, the place where she had to tell the biggest lies. April 14th, 1936, 3 a.m.
We have to read the signs,
Eddie said.
The dark stars may have aligned for us. It's time for us to go.
Eddie was squatting on the floor of the gymnasium, bobbing lightly on the balls of his feet like a broken jack-in-the-box. Frances did not believe in Eddie's astrological fascinations, but she usually entertained them. Not tonight. Everything was coming unspooled.
Let's run. Let's start the plan.
No,
Frances heard herself say. Her voice was like stone.
No, not now. We'll never make it now. Don't you know what this means?
It means the dark star.
Edward was about to go on one of his poetic nonsense trips about the dark star and the silver princess and all these characters he had in his head. He took his poetry too far sometimes, got caught up in symbols. Frances cut this off.
Whatever is going on, she said, our letter is mixed up in it. There will be cops, Eddie. Lots of cops.
So what? We're going to be outlaws.
If we go now, Frances said, we'll get caught in the first hour. We need to wait. Be cool about it.
Where's the fun in that?
Edward said, moving close to her, his breath on her lips. The fun, she said, pushing him back gently, is making our escape and getting out. When we go forever. We need to be smart. This is where it always fell apart with Eddie. He was so wild. He had the imagination, the dreams. But he didn't think about practicalities, like G-men, police dogs, and roadblocks. He wanted to be an outlaw without the discipline or practice of being an outlaw. It was up to her to keep him in line. That's why she had done so much of her own preparations. She had to get back to Minerva, back to her room. The things she needed were there.
They're making us leave anyway, he said.
Maybe for a day or two, maybe only for a few hours. You need to trust me. Keep your cool. Go home.
She pressed her lips hard against his and left the gymnasium. She couldn't risk using the tunnel. Miss Nelson might be in it, and the hatch on the other end would likely be bolted. She would have to go above ground. There was one advantage tonight, a blue sulfuric fog. This would likely be her only protection against the men with the shotguns. The air was bitingly cold now, and the fog went into her nose and mouth, tangling its way down into her lungs. She was up by the library, and in theory, she only had to make a straight shot across the top of the green to get home. But the door would obviously be guarded, and the entire area exposed. She would have to take the long route around, all the way through the far end of the campus, through the half-finished sites down near the road. She stayed low, moving from one tree to the next. She tripped over the roots and branches, and the leaves crunched under her feet. She saw the first gunmen in their overalls and coats, their shotguns slung over their shoulders. There were three of them, talking together by the cupola. She got down, her heart beating fast. They would shoot tonight. They would not hesitate. For one second, she tried to imagine the hot bullet sinking into her chest, the impact. It made her heart race painfully and her hands grew slick. She considered calling out, asking them for help. They would take her home to Minerva. She would get in trouble, but she wouldn't get shot. No, she pressed to the ground. She would be a cat. They loved cats here.
Cats know best, Albert Ellingham would say.
She would slink and slide. It was a big campus. She had the courage. Tonight, she would prove herself. The hardest part would be crossing the road. That was the most open area.
She would have to climb down the decline into the woods and cross somewhere in the dark. Frances made her way down the steep slope. Her expensive coat caught on brambles and made her trip, so she tucked it up and crab-walked her way down several feet. If she tried to stand, she was likely to tumble and hit every tree and rock all the way to the river. The rock cut her hands as she grabbed at the ground. Everything smelled of dirt and decaying leaves.
"What's that?"
one of the men said. She froze. A light shone through the trees.
"Probably an animal,"
another replied. Frances was very close to being sick. She swallowed hard and waited, not moving an inch. She froze. It must have been 15 or 20 minutes later before she moved again. Once she had made it a good distance from the statues and the men, she crept to the road's edge and, taking a deep breath, she ran across. It was a very slender road, so it was just a few steps. She fell into the culvert on the other side and bashed her face, but she did not cry out. She crawled on her belly into the dark. Then she went back up the hill. This was much harder. Her breath was labored now. Cops and robbers, G-men and guns, sneaking in the dark. And she was doing it. Frances Josephine Crane, the flower princess of Fifth Avenue, was crawling through the dirt and the night. She dug her nails into the ground with determination, not caring about breaking them. She didn't care about her clothes or her shoes. This was life. She crested the top of the incline and emerged on the other side of the road. Now she had to wind her way back up to Minerva. She moved slowly, working her way from building to tree to statue. The fog wrapped around her like a fur coat. It was easy. By the time she reached Minerva, she no longer worried about how she would get back inside. She would simply find a way. The door would be locked, but the window of her room was not. She went around the back of the building, then peered around the corner. No one was outside. She crept along and made her way to room 2. She tested the window first, trying to push it open. It did not give. Dottie's room? Dottie was a sneak, too. Did Dottie leave her window propped? She sometimes talked about liking to have it open a bit, how it reminded her of home, with the open window by the fire escape. She crept over to room 3 and looked at the window of the dark room. There was a tiny, tiny gap, only as wide as Frances's finger. But it was enough. She got a stick and levered it up ever so carefully, then pushed it, working slow and silent. Then she hoisted herself inside and closed it, inch by precious inch. She was inside Dottie's room, which, while technically like her own, was so much shabbier. There were no fur throws, no special furniture, no skis, no trunks of extra clothes, no radio or phonograph. Just what the school provided, and books, piles of books, neat and all over. Frances went to the door and, seeing no one, stepped out into the hallway and... Frances Crane! The overhead light came on and Miss Nelson stood there, looking flushed and furious. Frances Crane, the flower princess of Fifth Avenue and future outlaw, was busted cold just footsteps from her door. She opened her mouth to speak, though she was not sure what she would say. Something would come out. Miss Nelson, though she was in charge, was generally passive. She would say she was sorry, and... Miss Nelson was not passive tonight. Her rounded features looked sharper, and there was something in her face that suggested she knew exactly where Frances had been.
"In here,"
Miss Nelson said coldly, pointing to the common room. Behind her, a figure appeared, a man in overalls and a flat cap, holding a shotgun. Frances forgot to look surprised at this, and Miss Nelson's eyes grew narrow. Frances had given it all away. She did as she was told, going into the common room where one lamp was lit. The man with the shotgun went to the front window to look out.
"You will sit there,"
Miss Nelson said, pointing to the couch.
"And you will not move at all. You will sleep there."
She turned to the man by the door.
She doesn't move from that spot,
Miss Nelson said.
6. The great house would never fail to impress Stevie. This was exactly the effect it was intended to have. It was Albert Ellingham's palace, designed by several of the most famous architects and designers of the era to be a showstopper. The wood was rosewood, imported from India. The pink marble, the Austrian crystal, the Scottish stained glass. Everything in sight had been brought from some corner of the world for the express purpose of being part of this room, just to be seen, to be admired by Albert Ellingham and all he chose to invite. Right next to the front door, there was a head of steel-colored, closely cropped hair, and under it was Larry, as dependable as a grandfather clock, sitting at his large wooden desk. He was staring grimly into an Ellingham mug.
Hey, Larry, Stevie said. What's wrong with your coffee?
Some jackass bought pumpkin-flavored K-cups for the machine. If I wanted to ruin my day like that, I'd go ahead and eat a candle.
Not a PSL fan.
A what?
A door to the small security room behind him was tipped open. This had originally been one of the Ellingham receiving parlors. When Stevie had last seen it, it had some desks and a few monitors. Now the furniture had been removed on two walls and replaced by narrow control desks that faced walls of large mounted screens stacked too high, showing every angle of Ellingham Academy, with the views switching every 10 seconds or so.
That looks complete, she said.
Let me give you the tour,
he replied, standing up.
Come in.
Stevie followed cautiously. If Larry was showing her the security system, it was for a reason. He took a seat and typed something on a keyboard. Stevie's name came up on one of the screens. Then he began to see her morning's journey told in reverse. There she was at the great house door. There she was approaching the great house. There she was walking down a pathway alone. She stopped to stare at one of the cameras. She was scowling at it. There she was leaving breakfast. There was a close-up of Nate, Janelle, and Stevie going in to breakfast.
How is it doing this? She said. Facial recognition?
Sometimes it gets it wrong. And it's not very useful at night, but overall, it's not bad. There are also sensors in different locations that can read your ID at 6 feet. They call them listening posts. There are over 800 of them.
He hit return and her images were cleared.
Here's the thing,
Larry said.
People don't tend to change their behavior without reason. But make people see why they should.
Point made, Stevie said. I get it. You see it all. Larry did the thing where he pointed 2 fingers toward his own eyes and then to her.
And you leave any further inquiries to the appropriate authorities. Not that there will be any further inquiries.
Appropriate, Stevie said. Authorities, yes.
Good. They're waiting for you upstairs. You know the office.
Stevie backed into the main hall, then headed up the grand sweeping staircase. On the landing, there was the painting of the Ellingham family, done by their friend Leonard Holmes Nair. You couldn't just walk by the painting. It demanded to be seen. It wasn't overly large, maybe 4 feet high, which was nothing in proportion to the space. It was the color that gripped you first. The blue and yellow that swirled through the sky and slipped into the figures of the family. The bodies were almost an afterthought. The faces were the focus. And they blended in with the moon and the trees. It was like the landscape and the skyline were absorbing them, pulling them apart from each other and away from the world. It was a frightening painting.
Yes, a voice said, but we have that. We don't need it. We'll get it in a year or two.
The voice belonged to Dr. Jenny Quinn, the assistant head of the school, the one who looked like she drank student tears and ate lesser academics.
He wants to have a say, Jenny.
That was Dr. Charles Scott. They were having a discussion directly above her, on the 3rd floor landing. They were not speaking loudly.
but the acoustics in the hall were better than most theaters, and Stevie was directly under them.
He shouldn't have a say. Do you really want to be part of his narrative? Do you want him to be able to say he made Ellingham safe?
That had to be a reference to Edward King. Stevie backed up a bit to make sure she was not visible, but there was no hiding from Larry, who saw her lingering.
No, Dr. Scott said. I don't like him any more than you do. But wouldn't you rather have him do this? At least it's useful. He feels like he's done something and then he'll go away, hopefully. He's not going to go away. The man is a disease and his son isn't much better. I think that's unfair,
Dr. Scott said.
Isn't it worth trying to make him into someone who could do some good, rather than become a copy of his father at some prep school somewhere? I think you're fooling yourself. I want to have a board meeting, and I'm fine with that.
Right upstairs, Stevie,
Larry said, his voice booming up the steps. The conversation above her stopped abruptly, and a few seconds later, Dr. Scott appeared next to her, having come down the back steps, the ones the servants used. Dr. Charles Scott, a.k.a. Call Me Charles, was the head of the school and Stevie's advisor. Out of all the Ellingham faculty, he had the most bouncy personality, the one that said, learning is fun, in giant Comic Sans. He tended to dress in expensive geek chic, superhero t-shirts with designer jeans. His hair was somewhere between blonde and the earliest hints of gray. Today he wore a fitted black cashmere V-neck and gray wool pants, looking every inch the aged version of the perfect New England preppy guy. He sproinged up to her like a cartoon tiger.
Hey, he said, look who it is. I'm so glad your parents changed their minds.
Me too, she said.
Come on, let's talk.
Charles's office was along the right-hand corridor. All of the upper floors of the great house were open to the main foyer, except for the attic. The dark wooden doors were all very serious and handsome, but for Dr. Scott's, which had a message board full of stickers and signs that said things like, Challenge me, and Stand back, I'm going to try science. His office had been Iris Ellingham's dressing room, the famous dressing room that Flora Robinson disappeared into the night of the kidnappings. Many of the original features were still there. The pale silver wallpaper glowed bright in the autumn morning light. That was the real thing. Stevie recognized it from the photos. Some of the shelves and wall fittings were still there. Now, of course, the room was also full of bookshelves, a desk, chairs, file cabinets, a printer. Any open space on the wall was covered in Dr. Scott's diplomas and certificates. He had a lot. He waved Stevie into a chair and sat behind his desk, where he clasped his hands together.
How are you, Stevie?
He asked. Fine. He nodded and examined her for a moment, taking in her expression and body language. She straightened up.
I can't tell you how happy I was to hear you were coming back, he said. It's very brave what you're doing, after all that's happened.
It's fine, Stevie said. He made a noise of satisfaction.
You may have noticed we have some new security around here,
he said. I saw.
It may provide you with an additional layer of reassurance. Nothing is going to happen here. We had some tragic events this semester, but that's behind us.
Both Larry and Call Me Charles had now brought up the security system. Both had their reasons, but were they also telling her they knew Edward King brought her back? If so, why not just say it? Maybe no one knew. It was possible. Whatever the case, it was making her paranoid.
Do you feel ready to get back to work?
He asked. Stevie felt very ready to get back to her work, which was dealing with the fact that she had made the first major breakthrough in the Ellingham case in 80 years. But he probably meant schoolwork, and the answer to that was no, she was not ready for that. Definitely. She lied.
I've messaged all your teachers, so we'll get you back up to speed. There may be some bumps along the way, but we'll work it out.
There was a clock ticking somewhere in the room, loud, like a bomb. She glanced around for where the noise was coming from and saw a heavy green marble clock on the mantel, surrounded by books and framed photographs.
Was that clock there before?
She asked.
No, Charles said. We were rearranging some things from Albert Ellingham's office, and I brought it up here. Isn't that a beauty? The story is that it belonged to Marie Antoinette. I don't know if that was ever proven. I heard there was a piece of Marie Antoinette's porcelain here at some point.
A shepherdess, Stevie said.
Charles blinked behind his Warby Parkers.
Iris collected antique French porcelain, Stevie said.
Of course you would know about that, he said. Anyway, it seemed so sad to have something so beautiful in a room no one really goes in. It should be looked at. But let's keep to the subject at hand. Do you know this book?
He pulled a copy of Truly Devious, The Ellingham Murders by Dr. Irene Fenton from a stack of books on his desk. Stevie had worn this book through. It was the first read many people did on the subject. Stevie nodded.
I assumed so. I got a call from the author. Dr. Fenton teaches at the University of Vermont in Burlington. She's working on an updated version, and she's looking for a research assistant. We've placed several students at the university as research assistants. In your case, I don't think we've ever had such a good fit for a project. How would you feel about doing that?
Stevie tried not to actually bounce in the seat, but this was unsuccessful. Her spine became a spring, and she bolted up. Life had handed her a gift, a beautiful, unexpected gift.
What would I have to do? She asked.
Organize research, check facts.
Charles said it all casually, as if this wasn't the greatest thing in the world.
I can give you some credit for English and history for the work, as well as credit toward your individual project. And because of all the work you've done on this subject already, I can advance you a little time and credit to make up for anything you've lost.
She was already nodding.
Thanks, she said.
You never have to thank me for work you've done yourself. And I figured you would say yes, so I've set up your first meeting for tomorrow. Take the Burlington coach in the morning. She'll meet you at the Skinny Pancake at noon. It's a coffee and crepe place on the waterfront. You'll like it. Very popular. Sound all right?
It sounded better than all right.
Now,
he opened his laptop.
Let's get you updated on all your units for your classes as well. I don't know if you happened to continue any work on your reading or your language learning modules. Ha ha
ha ha ha ha ha ha ha ha. A half hour later, with a new schedule and an alarming set of personal academic benchmarks to meet, Stevie was released back into the wild, feeling a confusing blend of joy and terror, which was often a ticket to a ride on the anxiety roller coaster. There were people around, and she could have spoken to any of them. She could find Janelle and Nate and Vi. They would be happy to talk to her. Stevie was not going to do any of those things. She often found that when everything felt a little too much, she could not talk to anyone, even if she actually wanted to. She had a tendency to go where other people were not, to step into shadows when people walked toward her. She had a fondness for headphones and screens and ducking away, even as part of her wanted to be with friends, which meant she was going to the library to find some people who were probably dead. Namely, she was going to find Frankie and Edward, and Frankie and Edward were most likely to be found in the materials she had been hoping to get from Kyoko Obi, the school librarian. The library, called Asteria, was one of the campus's most magnificent buildings. Albert Ellingham thought libraries were holy spaces of learning, so he designed it to look like a small Gothic church with a turret. On the inside, it had a wild quality. Because of some architectural peculiarity, when you opened the door, it sent in a channel of air that swirled up through the open space, up and up around the balconies with their intricate spun steel metalwork that was like petrified lace. Colored light poured in from the stained glass windows that portrayed Greek titans. Helios, Selene, Metis, Eos, Leto, Pallas, and Perseus. Kyoko sat at a stool at a monumental desk, looking like a judge on high. Except in this case, the judge wore a fleece and still had the marks from a bike helmet in her hair.
Kyoko also ran the school's biking club and actually went up and down the entrance path on her bike every day, a feat that should easily have qualified her for the Olympics. The library was sparsely populated. A few people sat at the massive working tables, and they all had headphones on, so it seemed okay to speak.
You don't waste time, Kyoko said, greeting her. I only just got the message that you were back.
Stevie meant to smile and nod, but she ended up enacting the shrug emoticon. I need some research material, Stevie said. On here, on the school, I need to see anything about the first class. Lists of students, for sure. Do you have those? Kyoko nodded and took a swig from her Ellingham water bottle. She put a little sign out that said, "The librarian will be back," and waved Stevie through the dark wooden door with the words, "Library Office," written in gold. The front part of the Ellingham Library was a grand place, with its iron and glass and dark carved wood and the glorious selection of books. Many of the books had been around since the school opened in 1935. Fine, hand-picked volumes, many bound in leather, silent witnesses to the events that unfolded there. But it was the back office of the library that got Stevie excited. The back office contained the large metal shelving units of document boxes. If you loved crime, a document box was a beautiful thing. Anything could be in it. Files, clues, evidence. The document box was the thing to pick through, to find the lead, to find the single sentence on the single piece of paper that made you stand so suddenly that your head spun, and then you'd know that you cracked the case. That's how it happened in Stevie's head, anyway.
The early archive is back here,
Kyoko said, indicating one of the shelving units. You want the first year, 1935 through 36.
Right,
Kyoko said, heading to the end of the first row of shelves.
The 1935 through 1936 school year at Ellingham Academy was incomplete because of the kidnappings. The school's first full academic year started in the fall of 1938. You know all that.
Stevie nodded.
It was also a very small class. It was the experiment year, so the records aren't as extensive. There was no full yearbook. However, the school had produced a guide for the first class.
She opened a folio box and removed a small cloth-bound book. On the front it read, Ellingham Academy. The paper was thick and brownish, and the ink was a brownish red. The lettering looked hand-drawn.
There is a box of photographs as well, Kyoko said, handing Stevie a flat storage box.
From the rattle of the contents and the weight, it didn't sound like it contained a tremendous amount.
You can take those out into the main study room.
Stevie lifted the box and followed Kyoko back out, then settled herself at one of the big wooden tables and switched on a work lamp. She tried to contain herself as she opened the book. The first page contained an elaborate map of the campus, indicating buildings that were complete and buildings to come. There was a letter from Albert Ellingham welcoming everyone, a list of teachers and faculty. Stevie kept flipping until she got to the students. Each one got a third of a page. Frankie was staring up at her from the bottom of the very first page of entries. There was the girl who had dressed as Bonnie Parker. Stevie read the entry underneath. Frances Josephine Crane, New York City. Birthday, February 15th, 1919. Interests, chemistry, films, ballet.
Got you,
Stevie said under her breath. A few pages later, she found the next person she was searching for. Edward Pierce Davenport, Boston. Birthday, November 12th, 1918. Interests, literature, opera, art. In his school photo, Edward had a rakish grin, like he knew something the others did not. A bit like David. Stevie dug through the box of photographs. Many were of the buildings or the construction sites. Some were shots of the mountain view. There were pictures of the students sitting at desks and work tables in stilted poses. One pose was a dead ringer for an ad for an ambulance-chasing legal firm with about 10 people gathered around, smiling at one open book. Many of the furnishings were exactly the same as they were now, including pictures in this very library. She easily found Frances and Edward in a few of these photos. One thing jumped out at her. Frances and Edward looked rich. Frances was wearing 2 different fur coats in the photos, one short white jacket and a longer dark one. Edward also had a long fur coat, and he stood with the casual ease of a rich guy, the lean, the half-smile. Could these two students have kidnapped Iris and Alice Ellingham and Dottie Epstein? That would have been impossible, surely. Someone would have noticed that two students were missing on the day of the kidnapping, right? How would they have gotten off campus? They probably didn't have cars. Why would two students kidnap Iris and Alice Ellingham? And they wouldn't have been able to also beat up George Marsh, Albert Ellingham's FBI agent friend, in the middle of the night, or make the ransom calls, or have a boat on Lake Champlain 2 days later to collect the additional ransom money. Not alone. Could they have been working with other people? Did any of this make sense? Dottie Epstein turned up in the photos as well, and she did not look rich. Her clothes were plain, and she wore the same ones in most of the photos. But she looked much happier than Edward or Francis. Her smile was always wide, and she usually had a book in her hands or under her arm. "Can I scan these?" she asked Kyoko. "Sure." She allowed Stevie into the back again and pointed her to the scanner. "When I first got here," she said to Kyoko, "you showed me some old library records, things the students requested."
"Yeah?"
"Could I see it again?"
"You really are jumping back in,"
Kyoko said with a smile.
"I'll go and get it."
When Stevie had first looked at this list, it was to see the many materials Dottie Epstein had requested. Her initials, D.E., were next to her items. But someone else had requested pulp magazines. Gun Malls Magazine, Vice Squad Detective, Dime Detective, All True Facts Detective Stories. The initials next to most of these were F.C. Francis Crane. "Do you have any of these?" Stevie asked.
"I've looked for them," Kyoko said. "I'd love to find them, but they must have disappeared a long time ago. The students who asked for them probably took them and never gave them back."
The students who took them, Stevie thought, probably took them and cut them apart. If she could find these magazines online, she could look at the letters. She could compare the typeface of those magazines to the photographs of the truly devious letter. Or someone could. The FBI. Someone. She didn't have all the answers, but she had something. Now she had to do some of the drudge work and scan all of this to add to her files. She put on her headphones, turned on My Favorite Murder, and started with the student guide. Page by page, photo by photo, she got each image. After an hour or so of this, she returned to the main study room and opened her computer. Time for a basic search. Very little turned up about Frances Josephine Crane. It looked like there were a few references to her in social registers, some notes about her debutante ball, but nothing that seemed to go past around 1940, and not in much detail. Edward Pierce Davenport, however, did turn up several things. Wikipedia had a brief entry. Edward Pierce Davenport, 1918 through 1940, was an American poet. His only published work was the 1939 collection Milk Moon. Davenport was best known for his relationships with other American expatriate writers and poets in France in the late 1930s, and for his reckless lifestyle. He committed suicide in Paris on June 15, 1940, the day the Nazis entered the city. There was a little footnote there, so Stevie clicked it. It led her to a small excerpt from a longer book. On June 15, 1940, the day after the Nazis entered Paris, Edward Pierce Davenport spent the day consuming opium and violet champagne. At sunset, as loudspeakers in the street announced the night's curfew, he donned a gold dressing gown and climbed to the rooftop of his Parisian apartment on the Rue de Rennes in Saint-Germain. After toasting the city and the setting sun, he downed a last glass of champagne and swan-dived from the building into the street below. His body landed on a Nazi vehicle, denting the roof. "A fourth-rate poet," said a friend, "but a first-rate death."
"Your friends are real dicks," Stevie said.
"I know," replied a voice. "But they're the only ones I have."
This is when the screaming started. 7.
Squirrels, in Stevie's experience, were not obedient creatures, prone to forming themselves into well-regulated groups that moved as one. These squirrels were far too coordinated to her liking. They were streaming through the library, perhaps 100 of them. They were coming down the wrought iron steps, skittering along the edges of railings, all in an unbroken flow. This was only slightly more distracting than the sight in front of her. Spread out on the table was a pair of familiar hands, long, elegant hands. There was the worn-out t-shirt, strong, wiry arms. She followed these up to find brown eyes flecked with gold looking at her. Stevie yanked her legs up as squirrels began running under the tables.
"That's weird,"
David said, observing the chaos.
"So when did you get back?"
Stevie fought the urge to hit him with her laptop, largely because she did not want to damage it.
"What did you do?" she hissed. "Me?"
"Don't be a dick," she said.
"That ship has sailed. Hang on, we can't fight yet. Where's my hug?"
"Out," Kyoko said, pointing at David. "Everyone out."
"Well, that's not conducive to learning," David said under his breath.
Stevie grabbed her stuff, sweeping one or two photos from the collection into her bag, and hurried out as Kyoko started running around the library, checking windows and closing doors. The light outside seemed overly bright after the thoughtful shade of the library. David grabbed at his neck and rubbed the stubble that had accumulated there. David Eastman, or David Eastman King, was a shade under 6 feet, his build wiry, like he had been made of bundles of snapping electrical cables that had wound themselves together into a person, sparks still coming from the ends. His clothes were always tattered, and not fashionably tattered. His jeans had not been ripped by professionals. The holes and marks on his surfer t-shirt, he had made those himself through wear and carelessness. He wore a Rolex with a shattered face on his freckled arm, along with several string bracelets. Everything on his face was too narrow, too fine, the lines sharp. His eyes always looked half-closed, but they had more life behind them than most. It's the creature that pretends to be asleep that you need to watch out for. Even in his roughest state, he was beautiful to look at. In fact, if she was being honest, he was more beautiful in this state. Except in his jaw she saw Edward King, and his smile, and everything that had made him and supported him. It was a taste she would never be able to get out of her mouth.
"What the hell did you do?" she said.
"I'm excited you think I'm so powerful, but I don't control the local wildlife. God, so jumpy."
"I am your mandatory friend," she thought. For a second, she considered giving up right then and there. No way. No way could she carry on with whatever weird pretense. The case, the tin, the evidence, her one chance. Pix was hurrying across the green with some kind of box or carrier in her hand. She cast a look at David as she went, but did not come over to them or stop moving.
"Did you know,"
he said as Pix hurried on,
"that Dr. Nell Pixwell is a trained wildlife conservator? One of her many skills."
"What are you doing?" Stevie said. "Why did you send Pix to pick squirrels out of the library?"
"I need your help," he said. "Now, we've got maybe an hour."
"For what?"
"Ellie's room," he said. "I need you to do the thing you do. Look through it."
Stevie rubbed her face in disbelief.
"It's what you do," he said.
She was about to snap back that it wasn't what she did, except it was what she did. She had gone through David's room once when left alone in there just to try to find out what he was hiding from her. It turned out he was hiding a lot, so that was fair enough. And she went through Hayes's room after his death when she'd had the idea that something wasn't right, and it turned out something wasn't right. And Hayes was gone, so no harm, no foul.
"No," he said. "It's a good thing."
He was being serious, and his entire expression and bearing changed.
"Let me ask you a question. Does Ellie seem outdoorsy to you?"
"Outdoorsy?"
"She's the only smoker I know who can't light a match, Stevie. I saw her try. It was amazing. She uses a lighter because matches are too complicated,"
Last winter, I seriously thought she would kill herself trying to deal with the snow. She doesn't own boots. She has zero sense of self-preservation. She can't drive. She's made to live in cities and make art stuff. Now think about what it would take to get down off this mountain by yourself. The answer is, a lot. I've tried it.
I thought she snuck off all the time to go to Burlington, she said.
With me. She had friends down there with the cars. I helped them get on campus by messing with the camera at the entry gate. Ellie has a lot of talents, but she's not handy. So you're telling me that she ran away from here on no notice, carrying nothing, with no phone, no one waiting on the back drive.
That she got herself across the river.
She didn't use the bridge. As soon as she took off, Larry had someone on the road. That river is about 10 feet deep, rapid and cold, so she runs alone for miles through the woods in the dark, downhill, over a mountain river, to the road which is now being watched.
Okay, Stevie said. Okay, so what are you saying?
I'm saying something doesn't make sense, and I want you to do the thing you do and look through her stuff before it's gone, because you are really good at that, and I can't think of anything else. She's my friend. And I don't know where she is. If anyone could figure out where she's gone or if she's okay, maybe it's you.
Was this a trap? Because it seemed like a trap. Yet he said it plainly enough that Stevie felt it was probably the truth. David and Ellie had always been close friends. When Stevie had first arrived at Ellingham, she had watched the way they fell all over each other. Stevie thought they were dating. They weren't. They really were just friends. Also, David was not stupid. He knew that once this idea was introduced to Stevie's brain, it could only take root and grow. The vines would twist around her every waking thought until all other brain activity would be squeezed out, and all that would be left would be the leafy jungle of desire to search. And the tin had come from Ellie's room.
"You know you want to," he said. "Janelle is over in the maintenance shed working on her project, and Nate won't notice."
They had been reunited for all of 10 minutes, and already the library was infested with squirrels, and he was calling on her to break into a room. This was home. It all checked out.